Welcome back to Radio 4. On today's episode of iGenius, I'm joined by the audio artist known as John Rutledge, a.k.a. Eggsy, from the very famous and celebrated audio performance artist group Goldie Looking Chain, and other projects like The Unexplainers and many other things. John, great to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ian. I must say I'm very excited. I was not expecting to be called up to be interviewed for such a prestigious program. It's an honor to be here, and I, as I said, very excited. I am taking my trousers off now to release my inner joy, which you won't be able to see, but I assure you I will be releasing some juices during the evening. So yeah, a pleasure to be here, and thank you. Thank you for asking me on board today.
On Radio 4, we do encourage our listeners to also release their inner joy during the program. Maybe take some photos and send us an email or even write a letter. We don't discriminate on your digital accessibility if you want to release juices.
Naturally. Yeah. My 11-year-old son, Ian, just before I'm recording this, obviously, from my home in the Cotswolds, and my 11-year-old Ian, just before I came into the room, said to me, Father, I'm about to release my inner joy, and he closed his bedroom door, and I heard the sounds, and I knew then that he, probably at the very same time as me, will be releasing his inner joy.
Mm. Adolescence is a wonderful time.
Indeed, a great time to be alive. As for myself, over 85 years old now, I still have some of the inner joy within me, but getting it out isn't quite as easy these days.
And in this show, as always, we play a selection of clips from your library of work, much celebrated library, from your personal archives, from TV archives, radio archives. Our team of researchers have not been allowed to sleep for at least 60 days until we finally selected all these wonderful clips. And I hope, John, you don't mind going back to your childhood in Wales, where one of your early projects, Back on the Bins, we have a short clip of that was saved after BBC Wales burnt down in 1982.
I'd love to hear it. Fantastic.
Would you like to introduce it at all? What did that project mean to you at that point in your life as a young man in Wales?
I must say, Back on the Bins was very interesting. My very first ever role on television. Before that, I'd worked my way up through the RSC. I'd Bristol Old Vic. I'd put the hours in on the boards, treading them daily, learning the lines of Shakespeare, Othello, many of the classics. And of course, I reached a point where I just wasn't getting the work. You see. And I thought, this is it. I may as well go back to the fish and chip shop, which my father owned. You may be aware, my father owned a fish and chip shop.
Wonderful.
Elmo's Chip Shop in Newport.
It's still there. It's still there.
It's still there to this very day, run by my father, who, although deceased, is rigged up by a series of pulleys and wires, and he will serve you the chips. You pop a pound into his rectum, and he'll dish up the chips. It's rather wonderful. And, of course, you see, I just thought I couldn't get the work. I just couldn't get it. But I bumped into a man called Ian Barrington on the outskirts of Newport. We were both hiding in the bushes at the time. And Ian, of course, was the managing director of the BBC. And he noticed my red, rosy cheeks. He said, "You would be perfect. You would be perfect for this role in the new television drama called Back on the Bins," which was all about family life in South Wales and a struggling family during the turn of the century. And I got the role of little Jimmy Watkins, the tiny boy who sadly died after the first series, but I had my first ever speaking role there. And I can't remember very much about the shoot, but I do remember not wearing any trousers for the entire thing. It was wonderful. But I'd love to hear the clip. It brings back so many memories.
Right.
We all would.
So this is a clip, a very short clip of, and one of the few surviving clips of Back on the Bins.
Yeah. On closer inspection, they found out it was a bit of sweet corn.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine what he went through 2 weeks of that. Of course, he's fine now. He's back on the bins again.
Oh, love him.
fond memories there. Mm. That was Edith Applewhite was the lady you heard speaking there. Wonderful actress. Lost both legs in the war after accidentally standing on a landmine working in a munitions factory. Mm. And, of course, everybody thought it was over for her, but she went on to become one of the greatest actors in the world. Mm. Starred alongside Charlton Heston, Les Dennis, all of the classics, really, and, you know, sadly drowned whilst on holiday in Magaluf in 1987. But a wonderful woman and a great memory.
Wonderful, wonderful. I mean, you must be very proud to have such a legacy, especially to raise awareness of an issue like sweet corn.
Well, naturally, I mean, you know, up until that point, the issue of sweet corn being stuck in certain parts of the body had not been addressed. You know, publicly, even behind closed doors, people wouldn't talk about it, you know. And the writers there, Ian Ketheridge and Robert Burroughs, they took it to task to really make something that raised awareness of sweet corn getting stuck in various parts of the body. And that one episode was one of the highest rated episodes on television ever. 7.9 million people, you know, which was massive at the time, because only 400 people had televisions in the UK. Which you could imagine how influential it was. And of course, off the back of that, the Sweet Corn Awareness Board came to fruition. And now, of course, it's the biggest sweet corn awareness agency in the world. Wonderful.
Absolutely. Of course, it was a social movement as well. We all remember the corners. They would stand on street corners wearing T-shirts, yep, and waving sweet corn, throwing sweet corn at passing vehicles just to say, hey, think about it.
Yep. I mean, I remember going on a sweet corn awareness course throughout some of the schools of Great Britain, and I would turn up there dressed as a giant corn on the cob. I'd show them how easy it is to get stuck in a rather large rubber anus that we had created. And of course, they would all clap and cheer, but they left happy, but they left educated, which was very, very important, you see. Very important.
Which takes us on to your next clip. And you know, this is a very a good time to be in television. There was a lot of A-class drugs available to most presenters. The money was good. The perks were there. A lot of people were intoxicated and under the influence of many things while doing work. It was seen by many as a golden age compared to the kind of dour, sober time we live in now at the BBC. So tell me a little bit about Evil at Play. How did you come up with the idea that redefined sci-fi during that decade?
Well, you see, Evil at Play was very, very, very challenging play, a very challenging role to take on. I played the role of a psychic priest who was unaware of his psychic abilities. He was doubting his own faith in the church after losing his parents in a terrible house fire. And the role commanded that I played someone who just was questioning everything from his faith to the type of shoes he was wearing. Very, very challenging role. But Noel Tebbit, who wrote the script, came to me. He funnily enough, I met him whilst hiding in some bushes. And he, by pure coincidence, was hiding in the bushes as well. And he turned to me and he said, "You've got such lovely rosy red cheeks. Would you like to be in my play?" And of course, I jumped at the chance, not knowing what it was. He said, "I want you to play a psychic priest." And I thought, my God, I can't do this. I just can't do this. You know, we went over and over the script. We read and read for weeks and weeks on end. And it really was a challenge. But I think when it came to it, it was a live broadcast at the time. We didn't have tape in those days. And I really stepped into the role. I played it so well. I actually pissed myself in the final scene, which I think if you have the clip, you'll be able to actually hear the sheer terror coming out of me. I was a very, very young man. Very young man. And it was a very powerful role, which I feel I dealt with professionally. I mean, I've been so lucky. I've been so lucky to work with so many great people over the years. I just feel honored. Edith Warburton, Roger Nails, Peter Timbuktu, Jeanette Marie, all of them such fantastic, fantastic actors and actresses. And I was just so lucky. I always felt a little bit of imposter syndrome. But I think after I took this role on, I really proved my worth. I put my boots on and I showed them I was up there with the big boys. And I'm really very proud of this role. And I think, I would love to be able to hear the entire episode again, but as we know, the entire thing was lost after the cleaner threw it all in the bin. But to hear this clip would be a trip down memory lane, something wonderful.
This clip only survives because it was illegally recorded by the Soviet Union as they were trying to steal ideas. And they did their own version in Russian.
Which
was totally recast, totally redone. But they managed to work in the socialist perspective over the top of this. But I'll play the clip if you'd like.
Wonderful. I'll just say actually, before you play the clip, when the Russians did take it, obviously communism was strife, the socialist movement was incredibly foreboding. I got to hear a copy of that, and I must say the lead actor, Ilya Netvalukin, was fantastic. I couldn't understand a word he was saying, all in Russian, but the gurgles, the screams and the noises, and by all accounts, I don't know how true this is, but apparently he didn't just piss himself at the end, he actually shit himself. And rubbed it into his eyes. So that shows, regardless of his political beliefs, how bloody good an actor he was. So chin chin to him. Wonderful man. But I'd love to hear the clip. Please.
Yeah, this is evil at play.
You can take the blindfold off now. You're perfectly safe. Why have you brought me here? What do you want from me? Oh, I don't want anything from you, Richard. Quite the contrary. In fact, I want to give you something. Look, isn't this whole bloody charade enough? Just tell me what you...
The chair, Richard. Just sit in the chair.
What? But it's barely standing. The whole thing is so old. Look, let's just come to some agreement. I've got money. I can get you help. You don't have to do this.
Of course I don't. But you do, Richard. All I'm asking is that you sit in the chair.
And then you'll let me go.
Of course. No one needs to get upset.
Yes. Yes, no one needs to get upset.
Now, tell me what you can see. Tell me, Richard. What can you see?
Judith! Judith! I can see your faces! I can see them!
In Evil at Play, Baroness Thatcher was played by Margaret Dudridge, Michael Wood as Richard, and Colin Billany as the priest. Next on Radio 4, Jim Jarmusch takes us on a trip down memory lane.
Yeah, you can see how that was captured off the radio with the announcer at the time. How does that make you feel, remembering that? Do you have any kind of flashbacks?
I think the most prominent memory there was Margaret Dudridge, who played the role of Baroness Thatcher. Now Dame Margaret Dudridge, as we know. Wonderful woman, great screen presence, fantastic presence on the microphone, and a wonderful shock of bright red hair. Bright red hair, over 3 foot high across her head, and pubes to match, bulging out everywhere. You know, I mean, she would turn up for rehearsals, and they'd be coming out the sides of her trousers. You know, and on one occasion, I never forget, we were all in those days. Of course, everybody used to smoke, and we were sat there running through the script. And of course, I was smoking John Player Special at the time, a favourite brand of mine. I'll never forget. I lit the cigarette, and of course, some of the ash dropped off, and her pubes caught fire. You know, the woman was incredibly badly burned. Third-degree burns across the entire body, but she bloody well got on with it. She didn't even go to hospital. He just rubbed some chicken fat across the burnt flesh, and she just got on with it. You know, she said, bloody good job. Bloody good job, and a great woman. And shortly after that, we became great, great friends. I would often go round and dress the wounds, rub the cream into the burns, and we ended up being incredibly good friends, both of our families, and we used to go yachting across the Solent, And I remember once we got in the boat and she accidentally fell in and drowned. But it didn't matter because we all had plenty of wine. And we got back to the mainland and got incredibly drunk and then went home. Haven't seen her since. I imagine she is long dead now. It was 1978. But a wonderful woman with a shocking amount of red hair, both in between the legs, under the arms, up the back, across the stomach even, and across, of course, on top of her head. A wonderful woman, great actress, and great, great memories to hear that again. In many ways, I wish I could relive those days, but of course, time passes, things happen, triple bypass surgery, losing one's toes to frostbite whilst trying to climb Everest, and even the restraining order have certainly slowed down a lot of my attempts at working now. But to hear those things, the glory days, Ian, wonderful. And it really does make me feel rather special to have been chosen to have gotten that far. Because so many actors do try. So many actors do try, but they don't quite get there. You know, they end up sort of, you know, becoming heroin addicts, alcoholics, you know, working in Subway, making the sandwiches. I'm so honoured. I'm so very honoured, Ian. And yes, Evil at Play will forever stay with me. In fact, I was thinking when I die, I may well have simply the words, get in the chair. Inscribed on my headstone. And I think those who come will be able to see it. And it will mark that great bit of work. Not just mine, but everybody else involved. Wonderful.
And of course, we know that Stephen King credits his entire career to hearing that as a young boy. And the
of course.
3 weeks of sleepless nights from the trauma of it meant that it warped his mind to go on to create, you know, some of the greatest horror novels. You know, how do you feel knowing, and I keep using the word legacy, knowing that, you know, modern horror was defined by the inspiration from that sci-fi that had a very small budget.
Incredibly small. Four shillings was the entire budget the BBC had given us. But I know, the fact that it's had such the ripple effect is fantastic. In fact, I met Stephen King in 1987. I went on holiday to Orlando by myself. I'd had a terrible argument with my wife. I disliked my children greatly at the time. And I decided to go to Orlando for 2 or 3 weeks alone with only £400 in my pocket, nowhere to stay. I didn't know anybody there. I couldn't get into Disneyland. They wouldn't let me in because of the restraining order. It does carry across to the United States. And of course, I was walking the streets with a bottle of plum wine in my hand, and I bumped into this man who immediately stopped me. He said, "Excuse me, sir, are you? I said, "Yes." And he introduced himself as Stephen King. And he was a very young man at the time. He said, I'm an aspiring writer. Would you read this for me?" And I got to read one of his very early manuscripts based on, well, what would become Christine, the story of the haunted car, which, as we all know now, has gone on to become not just a best-selling book, but, of course, a great film as well. And, of course, in this very early version of the story, it was actually a slight variation. It was a haunted cheese grater, and it was about a young boy who worked in a pizzeria who had come across a secondhand cheese grater that had been badly damaged, and he lovingly brought it back to life, but it was haunted by the ghost of an Italian pizza maker. And this ghost taunted him. It taunted him until he realized it just wanted bad things out of him. And eventually he grated himself to death, starting at the balls. Incredibly graphic story. But I loved it. And I said, "Stephen, good luck to you." And I patted him on the back, patted him on the buttocks, patted him on the balls, put my fingers in his mouth, and he went on his merry way. And look at where he is now. A wonderful man. All from my work, which I'm very, very honored. Very, very honored to have had the opportunity to have done.
And next on to what is described as your cake period.
The golden days, yes.
I think you found cake as a topic and then you ran with it and pushed it beyond the logical kind of conclusions that most mortal minds could take it and took it to new places. And you had a high-flying collaboration with some of the most famous bakers and some real household bakers household names in like in popular culture, and in terms of what people ate, they were, you know, and it came, it went back around your, you know, your work then influenced the bakers themselves and how they how they made things. So tell us a little bit about the Mr. Kipling project.
Well, Ian, you must remember, you know, in the 1940s, the 1950s, rationing was still happening. You know, people, I didn't see a banana until 1952. People couldn't get access to food the way they can now. You know, if you were to pop into the shop, you could buy some Finder's crispy pancakes now. You could buy a pint of chocolate milk, hundreds and thousands, salt and vinegar crisps, beans with mini sausages, and of course, cakes. But in those days, it was very, very different. And I had always been obsessed with cakes ever since my mother tried to cook one and put me inside of it as a young boy. And I got the opportunity to write a script for David Bertridge, who at the time was the chief commissioning editor at the BBC. I, funnily enough, met him whilst I was hiding in a bush. And by pure coincidence, he was hiding in the bush as well. And he turned to me and he said, well, put your trousers back on, dear boy. Would you like to write a script for me? I said, well, how did you know I'm involved in the theatre? He said, I could tell by your wonderful rosy red cheeks. And I agreed. We chuckled. We hugged each other, kissed. And then I said, do you know what? I'd love to write something. I'd always been on the other side of the microphone or the camera. And he said, well, look, I'll give you 3 weeks. Come up with something. And if we like it, we'll commission it. And I went home and I ate a Battenberg cake, which at the time was incredibly rare. You couldn't get marzipan for love nor money in the country at the time. But a friend of mine had just come back from Italy and he'd managed to get some grade A marzipan. He'd made this wonderful Battenberg cake. And I sat there eating it and I thought, do you know what would be fantastic? A play set in an Edwardian boarding school about some young boys who are top of the class, some of the most intelligent minds of their time, but they're restrained by their environment. And, of course, one of them should be related somehow to Mr. Kipling, who, as we know, is one of the greatest cake chefs in the world, if not the universe. Kipling himself, of course, was still in... in college, learning cake artistry. But I knew him. I'd met him whilst hiding in a bush, and I'd been speaking to him. And I thought, this man's fantastic. I'm going to use him as the influence for the main character. So I put this play together about a young boy who had been related to Admiral Mr. Kipling, was responsible for one of the biggest cake chains in the world, who became obsessed after the death of his father and become psychotic. Of course, funnily enough, I mean, art reflecting reality, Kipling himself did go on to become one of the most famous cake makers in the world, if not the universe. And this play, well, let's just hear the clip, Ian. I think it's the only way we can really do it justice. And then I'd love to tell you some more. To tell you some more about the whole production.
Wonderful, wonderful. Okay, this is Mr. Kipling.
Help me.
All that over cake, but why cake? He's got sherbet, Twix, even Calippos. Why cake?
It's quite simple. You see, his father was Mr. Kipling.
The Mr. Kipling?
Yes, the Mr. Kipling, inventor of the fondant fancy, the Viennese whirl, even the Bakewell tart. After he died, he was just never the same again.
Oh, Cribbins, it looks like we might be in trouble.
But why? You haven't touched it, have you?
No, not me, but the headmaster. He's got the marble slab cake in his office.
My God. The parents' evening. Get in touch with Wiggis. Get him out of Latin class. We need to fix this, and quickly.
Run, boy, run!
Wonderful.
Poignant, very poignant. And again, I'm very, very honoured to have been involved. To have the opportunity to even write something was a pleasure. But actually get to play a role as well was absolutely wonderful. And I must say, in that clip there, acting alloongside me was David Fauntleroy, who was a wonderful man. He sadly had lost both eyes, all of his fingers, four of his toes, a kneecap, one of his bottom cheeks and both of his lips in a terrible accident with a seal. A few years previously, he'd been a sailor. And in the Merchant Navy during the war, he'd fallen off the boat, the ship that was on the SS Ronnie Size, and of course he had to fight over 14 sails. He was in the water for 2 days straight fighting, and they virtually ripped the man apart. Tatters, absolute tatters. But he came out of it, came to the other side, and funnily enough, it was acting that saved him. Apparently he was in the bed. They told him he had 2 weeks left to live. He said, fuck you, I'm going to do Shakespeare. And he bloody well did. He took it to the old Vic, and it was a masterpiece. You know, wonderful man. And he went on for many, many more years. He lived to be 108, ended up in a home in Chile. Yes, South America, running drugs, doing cocaine every day until the day he died in a gun battle. Wonderful, wonderful man. And he shall be greatly remembered. I, in fact, have a photograph of him in front of me on my mantelpiece. I can see it now.
Life well lived.
You're a wonderful man. Wonderful, wonderful man. And you must excuse me if you can hear in the background, my wife Margaret is hoovering at the moment, but don't let that put you off.
No, that's fine. That's fine. last week we had our guest was David Attenborough. And
David, yes. I met David on one occasion, actually. A few years ago, I was actually hiding in a bush at the time, and he, by pure coincidence, was hiding in the bush as well. And I asked, are you David Attenborough? He turned to me and said, yes. He then remarked on what lovely rosy red cheeks I had, kissed me on the mouth, and disappeared. Never saw him again, but a wonderful man.
Yeah, he was talking about the fact that when he was in Afghanistan recording or trying to spend months looking for snow leopards, that the only entertainment they had was copies of Mr. Kipling on VHS and DVD, yes. and even the text-based version of, on floppy disk, and that it got him through and reminded him so much of his days in school, and also made them crave cake. But obviously, yeah. there was no Mr. Kipling cake for thousands of miles at that point. And when the crew returned, they threw a big party, and they didn't. Attenborough and his crew didn't want any more cocaine or A-class drugs or any of the alcohol. They just feasted on French fancies.
It's funny because I meet so many young boys who run up to me in the street and they ask me about cake. You'll be amazed. You know, can I see your gingerbread man? Oh, can I see your lemon fondant fancies? You know, oh, let me have a look at your Victoria sponge. And of course, I bring them all back home. And every Sunday, I invite all the local boys in. And my wife will cake, you know, 15 or 17 cakes. She'll lay them out on the table. And all the boys will come in and mark them out of 10. And then the best cake, we all get to sit on it and rub it into our faces. And it's such a joy to know that I'm responsible for that. I'm responsible for bringing those boys into my house and showing them my cakes.
So much pleasure for so many of the boys.
Of course, and that's what it's about. You know, you're not here for a long time. You're here for a good time, Ian. And that's the way I've always looked at it. You know, that's why I did the heroin throughout the 80s. You know, that's why I did the cocaine in the 90s. And that's why I bought a gun. Because you're here to enjoy yourself. You're not here for anybody else's wishes. You're here to have a good time. I mean, recently I had a slide installed in the top window of the house, which goes straight down to a giant paddling pool, which is so much fun, especially for an 80-year-old. So much fun in the summer when it's hot. I'll strip down to absolutely nothing and I'll slide straight down into the garden, and people walking past will applaud. Some of them will even take photos.
Nice. Anyway. now the final clip we have is actually new work that nobody has heard before. I think this is your Mona Lisa, if you ask me. This is your this is your Jurassic Park 2.
Indeed.
This is definitely your Aliens Resurrection.
And I think so.
I've only heard snippets of it and secondhand information, and you know the kind of whispers you hear in the corridors at the BBC, yeah. Of you know, those whispers usually build to shouts and screams of excitement at these kind of projects. And I don't know how to how are you to even begin to frame a question about the project that is known as Tebbit?
Yeah, Tebbit. Now, a wonderful piece, originally a monologue, written by a good friend of mine, Ronnie Colditz, who Colditz, if you've never heard of him, has been writing for many years. He's written for all the greats, Barry Took, Miranda Sawyer, David Attenborough, Les Dennis, Michael Jackson, Myra Hindley, Rod Stewart, all of the classics he's written for over the years. And he, funnily enough, got in contact with me after we met each other whilst I was hiding in a bush. I was on the outskirts of East Midlothian in Scotland. I often take time out there. I was hiding in this bush. And of course, Ronnie was also in the bush as well. And I'd never met the man before. And he turned to me and he said, "Excuse me, are you?" I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, my name's Ronnie Colditz. I'm a writer. I've obviously witnessed some of your work over the years. And I would love to ask, you've got such lovely red rosy cheeks. Would you like to be in a play of mine?" And of course, I jumped at the chance. And he sent me the script and I read it in 2 days. And I said, "Sign me up." And it's a wonderful, wonderful story about young boys, again, set in a boarding school, young boys who are coming to terms with their own age, entering the field into manhood. And one of them is incredibly badly bullied by a very nasty piece of work called Tebbit, who does something terrible, which you will find out about in the play later on. And of course, he has to live with that afterwards. And we see the side of him that he never wanted to show anybody. And eventually, something happens to him that makes him realize that he was a bastard. And I think this clip really does do the whole thing justice. And I'd love if you could play. Incidentally, when I recorded this monologue, I didn't have any clothes on at all. The stench was outrageous. But if you could play if you could play the clip, it would be very helpful.
I will. I'm gonna play it now. Here we go. This is Tebbit.
"I'll do it," Wiggins said sheepishly from behind the gaggle of boys. For a moment, the commotion stopped and they turned their attention from the riverbank, focusing through the sun-drenched haze on Wiggins' misshapen skeletal frame. Tebbit stepped forward, exerting his dominance. "Are you still here, Wiggins? I thought you would have run off with the other plebs." Wilson and Critchley sniggered, clutching their homemade spears tightly, the mud from the riverbank smeared across their faces and chests. "I said I'll do it," Wiggins replied with a confident defiance. Tebbit poked him forcefully on the shoulder. "Nonsense. You've never done anything before. What makes you so bloody special anyway, you traitor?" He paused. A sudden moment of realization. "Go on then. Do it. Do it now or I'll smash you and send you back to Mr. Wilkes with a bloody nose." The rest of the group circled around him, instinctively turning the instruction into a low, brooding chant.
Do it.
It was now or never. Wiggins took a deep breath and ran. Ran like the wind, and when he reached the riverbank, threw himself with all his might into the swirling mass beneath him. If he could just make it across, if he could just get to the other side and retrieve the dead German's helmet, or even his gun, maybe. Maybe then they would accept him. It was November when they found the body. Swollen, bloated, unrecognizable apart from the distinctive port wine birthmark across his face and neck. The official report had recorded death by misadventure. But Tebbit knew what had really happened. Tebbit knew the truth, and now, 3 decades later, Tebbit was about to come face to face with the consequences.
Fa la la la, Tebbit knew the truth. Fa la la la, Tebbit knew the truth. Fa la la la, Tebbit knew the truth.
Wonderful.
Wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And it's such a joy and honour to have been asked to take part in that role. And, of course, nominated for BAFTAs, Oscars, you know, various awards. The South Wales Argus gave it a some kind of plaque. But a wonderful, absolutely wonderful thing to be involved with, you see. And, you know, some of the people I work with there, Gary Lyons, Peter Strawbridge, Sue Lawley, Jesus of Nazareth, Craig David, David Bellamy, David Icke, David Davis, Big Gary Davis, Small Gary Davis, and Gary Davis, the radio presenter. All of them were such a wonderful cast and such a wonderful group of people. And it was an honour, really, to have done that. And the fact that they managed to get me into the studio at my age with the restraining order still against me was no mean feat. And I'm incredibly proud of that piece of work. And I hope many people get to hear it, because it's something that has made my life and many more people's lives very, very pleasurable.
And of course the premiere for Tebbit will be in your hometown next week, but then there will be the North American premiere in LA the week after, and
yeah,
2 days
right.
later the Asian premiere.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously this whistle stop tour of these cultural centers around the world and the kind of celebrities that are there. How do you stay in touch with that young boy from Wales?
It's a great question. I think it's very important to stay in touch with your childlike side. You know, anybody, no matter from what age, 8 on to 80, it's very important to stay in touch, you see. So what I find I will do, especially with these sort of whistle-stop tours around the world, it's non-stop flights, hotels, flights, cars, jeeps, aeroplanes, boats, helicopters, hang gliders, roller skates, small model cars, full-size cars, tanks, armored vehicles, all of them. You're non-stop traveling. And it's important to stay in touch with that childlike side, because otherwise you would just stop. You would just give up and die. So what I find I do, I'll take a large adult-sized nappy with me. I'll put a bow in my hair, a dummy in my mouth, and I'll just lie in a giant cot I've had specially made for me by MFI, More Furniture Ideas, great company. And, of course, I'll be escorted around me. Goo, goo, gaga, sound. Goo, goo. Goo, goo, gaga. Goo, I'm a baby. I'm a goo, goo. I'm a baby. And I'll do that for the entire thing. And it keeps me young. It keeps me young. Of course, I will soil myself every 3.5 hours. And somebody does have to feed me through their tit, which isn't very nice for anyone to look at. But it keeps me going. It keeps me going. And that's what it's all about, you see.
It sounds like a unconventional approach to fighting the aging process, but you know, I imagine that there are many who kind of raise an eyebrow when they see you, but obviously with the evidence is there that it works, because you show no sign of slowing down as you kind of enter your 12th decade on this planet.
And actually, I mean, I've had both my liver, my sphincter, my spleen, my heart, my kidneys, both my big toes, all removed and replaced with Adidas sports bags. And, you know, at first I thought it was going to be a bloody nightmare, but I must say I am fighting fit, absolutely ready to take it on. And this morning, only this morning, you know, I went out for a 52-mile run. Sadly, my knees don't work anymore. So what the wife does is tie me to the back of the car and drag me for 52 miles around the Nantwich area, which is where I live now. And it's so refreshing. It makes one feel alive. Just to get up at 4 a.m., wait for the sun to come up, wait for Edith to tie a rope around my neck, fasten it to the Hillman Imp, turn the engine on, and then drag me 52 miles or so around the streets. It really does make one feel alive. And that's what keeps you young. I think the moment you give up is the moment you start watching daytime television with your Richards and Judys or your whatever it's called, and you end up giving up, which is no good for anyone. So yes, very good, very important to stay alive.
And if a young boy was listening to this and they would like to emulate your prestigious and lengthy career, what would you What piece of advice would you give to them? What would you say that would allow them to, that would give wind to their sails for for the kind of 12-decade career you've had?
I think it's a very good question. I think my advice would be to any young boy looking to break into the world of acting, show business, radio, television, films, cartoons, stories, pictures, graffiti on walls of Willy's, or even accountancy. I think any young boy should take this advice and take it to heart. If you own a BMX, why not attach some blades to the wheels and drive past your enemies, take them out before they can take you out. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. And if you can't get a knife, try poisoning them. Yes, poison. I've got a ring, you know. It looks just like a rather large opal. Very big thing. I normally wear it on my index finger. And this ring, you see, you can flip it open and it keeps a type of poison inside. A rare type of poison I got from South America. And of course, if you pop it in someone's drink, they've got no longer than 3 seconds to survive. And I managed to work my way up by poisoning everybody who was against me, anybody who denied me. Took a dose of the old, you know what. Kill them all.
Great. That's wonderful advice. And I can imagine there are a lot of young people out there listening in the cars with their family on the way to primary school, secondary school, or all of the schools. They're probably sat there thinking, yeah, you know, I would like to be a star. And if it means poisoning my enemies or those who stand in my way, then that's a really positive message you can share.
I only hope all the best to anybody. And I wish them all good luck, whether they are young boys in Japan, Germany, India, China, the Bay of Bengal, the Bay of Biscay, anywhere in France in general, Holland, Australia, especially the West Coast, although the East Coast equally, America, all parts of America, North America, and of course Canada. Any of the countries, I wish them all the best of luck. And I hope my legacy lives much longer than me. And I hope it goes on for many, many more years. And I would assume that after my time is up, after I pass, my wife will carry out my wishes of having my body stuffed and placed on the front of a happy eater, if they're still there. If not, I'll just memory services. I'll be happy to have my body placed outside the front of memory services. For all and sundry to see.
And my last question, which is always the hardest one, and one that can sometimes stir dark memories from a life well lived. Can you tell me what your greatest regret is?
Such a powerful question. I think there's one rule I live by. I've always said it's nice to be important, but it's very much more important to be nice. And in 1958, I punched a baby. I was very angry at the time. I was drinking a lot. I was out of work. I didn't know who the baby was. I was in St. John's Wood in London. It was in a pram, and I walked past and I punched it. And I wish to God I'd punched the mother instead. Sadly, we live with these things hanging over us, and there's not a day go by when I don't think about punching that baby. And I wish, if only I could have done something different. But nonetheless, I never got caught for it. And who knows if he lived or died. But anyway, still here. Still here. Help me. Cough in my left side. Edith. Call hospital. Help me.
Next on Radio 4, John Humphreys is back with his show where he tours the country looking at medieval sex toys.
Demon Sea.
Walker, you must be mistaken.
It's now, it's here.
Come on down here and help with it.
Demon Sea.
Paranormal existence.
You mean to say you came here purposely?
The first move in the great conspiracy had been made.